You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, as the Chinese Communist Party Congress kicks off in Beijing, we'll ask what President Xi's political ambitions mean for those both at home and abroad. My guests, Mary Dajewski and James Boyes, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including another tumultuous week in Washington.
The traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it.
We'll also be discussing Armando Iannucci's latest satire, looking at the death of one of Russia's most notorious leaders.
Stalin's dead.
He's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Oh my God.
Our general secretary is lying in a puddle of indignity.
Yeah, he's feeling unwell, clearly.
And we'll ask whether MPs here in the UK should be doing part-time jobs on the sidelines. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and James Boyes, political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you here with us. The Chinese Communist Party Congress is underway in Beijing. It's no regular political gathering. The Communist Party of China, of course, has held power since the founding of the Republic. And judging by President Xi Jinping's proclamation of the country looking forward to a new era of Chinese politics and power, it's going to stay that way. Speaking for well over 3 hours, Xi reportedly paused for just one sip of water, which is pretty impressive, I think. But what does an emboldened China, and Xi indeed, mean for the rest of the world? Well, here to tell us, James and Mary Dajewski. And Mary, perhaps I'll start with you. What do you make of, I don't know, what we see when we look from without to the Congress? It's often talk about, well, you know, the order that people move in is most important. That matters more than the substance of what's said. Xi certainly wasn't worried about being snappy today. What are the takeaways?
Well, I think, from what I've seen of, 3.5 hours, he had actually some very interesting and from probably a rest of the world perspective, some rather disturbing things to say. I mean, one of the things he said was that he said that China was the right force, and you sort of hope that maybe there's a slight nuance of translation here that went wrong, to lead the world. He talked about rejuvenation. He talked to a degree about corruption in China, which has become a sort of cause of his, though you never quite know when Chinese leaders or indeed any other leaders talk about corruption, whether they mean corruption and that they really want to get rid of it, or whether they see it as a tool to frame and get rid of their enemies, because there's very few people that would actually be exempt from any charge of corruption who's got anywhere in a country like China. So there are all those things going on. But you alluded initially to, as it were, the pageantry and the choreography of these occasions. And it took me back because I covered the 13th Party Congress, which was a very, very long time ago. And one of the things about these, this is an enormous gathering. It's almost impossible to imagine this in a sort of, on a Western scale, because it is so huge. The number of people going, the scale of the Great Hall of the People, Tiananmen Square, which will probably, I mean, I haven't seen the pictures, will probably be deserted because of security. All the delegates being bussed in. It is a fantastically orchestrated occasion. And when you talk about, looking at, as it were, the pecking order and who's who in the lineup, it's hard to say that this is as important now as it was, say, 25, 30 years ago, but I suspect that it is. China to us is still not one of the most scrutable countries. And being up or down, where you are, when you come in, there's a lot of that going on.
And it was certainly interesting to hear some of the substance. I thought this point about global leadership, and he was at pains to point out this meant politically, economically, militarily, even environmentally, he said. I mean, James, surely from your point of view, that's the United States' job, isn't it? To lead the world on issues of that character?
Well, there's a terribly old cliche I'm going to fall back on, which is that power pours a vacuum. And I think that what you're seeing here is a recognition that if Donald Trump isn't up to the job, doesn't want the job, and people aren't prepared to follow him necessarily, and we're seeing evidence of that already, somebody will. And we've seen, I think, several pretenders to the throne. Clearly, Macron, for example, stepping forward. The Canadian leader Trudeau, I think, attempting to do something along the similar lines. It's a shame that there's nobody necessarily of greater stature here in the United Kingdom at this point to step forward.
We're quite a long way short,
yeah,
sadly.
Absolutely. So, on that basis, you can clearly look at China and say, well, if it isn't going to be the US, who is it going to be? Clearly, Putin, I think, would love to be in that obvious role. But I think, considering some of the things that he's been up to, and we're going to continue talking about that this afternoon, I think, it seems that what you're seeing coming out of China at the moment is a recognition that this could well be their moment. It's the idea of stars aligning, the timing is right, the economy is buoyant. And let's not forget, China holds a great deal of American debt at this point. If the Chinese were to call that in, that would make life interesting in the US, certainly. You're seeing the attempt by the Chinese leadership to expand its territorial control and influence over a range of areas in the South China Sea. And I think at a time when the Americans are busy saber-rattling on the Korean Peninsula, this could very well be an interesting opportunity for the Chinese to elaborate upon what they're now referring to, apparently. And again, we were talking about China, translation. The translation I saw was the Chinese dream. Mm. Now, how about that for an idea? At a time when the American dream is apparently declining at home, we now see the rise of potentially the Chinese.
There was another quote, actually, that I picked out from a lot of what Xi Jinping said, which was that no country can afford to retreat into isolation. And you can read that in several ways, but one of it is absolutely as a sort of scolding remark directed towards Washington. But you can also see it as a statement of intention by the Chinese, that they have no intention of passing up any opportunity. And also, when you think back to Davos earlier this year, and you think of the Chinese presence and Xi Jinping being at Davos and basically preaching globalization at a time when pretty much everybody else was taking another look at globalization and asking whether it was really such a good thing.
Well, Mary, I wanted to ask you about that specifically, and actually to pick up on that point that James made about this sort of vacuum of leadership emanating from the White House. How reactive, in your experience, and you mentioned back to the 13th iteration, when you were looking on, how reactive to, for example, global political dynamics, what's happening in Washington, would Xi and his, one imagines, team of speechwriters, for example, be? Because one rather expects it to be preaching to the gallery, or certainly principally to a domestic audience. But do you think that dynamic has changed quite fundamentally?
I think it probably has. And I get the impression that China and Beijing today are much more aware of how they're perceived in the outside world than many people and many leaders actually in other capitals. And it may be something that Xi Jinping has learnt during the time that he's been in office. But certainly new leaders often find it extremely difficult to balance the fact that they are actually talking to the world the same time as they're talking to their own people and getting those messages sort of in alignment. But it's also interesting for me in a sort of personal bookend type way, because the 13th Party Congress was the one where Deng Xiaoping bowed out. It was also the first one that they sort of opened up to foreign journalists, with the first session and the last session being open. And they had spin sessions at the end of each day when we could ask questions about what was going on. There were all these rumours about who was up, who was down in the provincial leadership as well as in the national leadership. And I imagine that that has been vastly extended over the years, so that this year a lot of the questions will be directed towards the foreign audience and towards China abroad.
James, perhaps just on the reflections on the sort of pretty uncompromising tone he struck more broadly about the sort of political model of China, a recommitment that, you know, we weren't going to see extensive democratic reforms or anything really along that line. Again, he struck quite a tough tone on Hong Kong, for example, where we've seen some sort of democratic expressions, if you like, in recent times. Can one read that much into the focus of his remarks, the style of his oratory on those themes? Or is that, I don't know, does it remain as hard to read as ever?
You know, let's be frank, I'm not going to claim to be, you know, an old China hand here and have any great insight. But I think what is telling, I think, is the fact that, you know, as Mary was saying, this is now being viewed and listened to by the world. This isn't just for domestic consumption. He's clearly sending a message about the direction of travel over the next 5 years. And it's, as you point out, it's interesting to see what he's not saying. He's not talking about opening up democratic reform. He might be talking about the Chinese dream, but I'm quite sure that means something very, very different than we might imagine sitting around here in London or in Washington. He's not talking about a Jeffersonian image of Beijing come the 2020s. Now, that's interesting because, of course, one of the great aspirations going back 25 or so years ago, when you saw the collapse of the Berlin Wall and what happened in Russia, where you saw problems in terms of the reform there and in the immediate aftermath of the clampdown in Tiananmen Square, was a recognition that, well, if we try to push too hard for political reform in China, it's clearly not going to work, and we've seen what's happened. So let's try and get market reform going there on the basis that you'll hopefully eventually get an emerging middle class that will eventually demand democracy, and you'll get democracy through the back door. Well, here we are now, you know, 25 odd years later on, and whilst China is a remarkably different country than it was then, clearly by today's pronouncements, we shouldn't expect democracy on the mainland or in Hong Kong anytime soon, quite frankly.
Just a last note on President Xi, a number of observers saying this is a president who's consolidated power, maybe more sort of intensively even than some of his predecessors. Would you broadly go along in that in a word or two?
I think I probably would. I mean, it seems that he's taken what looks like quite a strategic approach to being Chinese leader, and that he sees himself there at least for two terms. Whether he'll get or even try to get a third term, obviously, is way down the line. But it's interesting to watch him. You know, this is a guy with a game plan, but he's also, you know, almost increasingly you see a ruthless side to him, in the way that, you know, people have been kidnapped, driven abroad, killed, and I think the idea that there's one man's rule and the Communist Party, he's ruling in the name of the Communist Party, you know, these are things that we forget, because economically China's rise has been so spectacular, you tend to forget that all those other things are actually in place.
Let's move on. This week, Donald Trump has found time to revisit a number of his favourite topics once again, the 2016 race against Hillary Clinton. Amongst them, he's also managed to upset some of the families of the US military's war dead. He's also had his latest attempt to ban travel to the US from selected Muslim-majority nations halted too. James, in some ways it pains me to ask you for your insights, but...
Well, thank you very much.
No, by which I mean, it's just so depressing to chart this sort of succession of pronouncements, if we can even term that. What do you make of this latest week in Washington, if you like?
Where do we begin? You know, it's funny, when Trump became president, I made quite a concerted effort to say, well, you know, I'm not going to become a professional Trump critic. There's going to be enough of those. But here
it's
we are.
It's hard not to follow.
It's hard not to be. You know, any one of these stories in any other administration would be headline news for a week. And in that brief introduction there, which was not as brief as you might have liked, because there's at least three stories there, quite frankly. You know, we're talking about a series of calamitous missteps, at very least, quite frankly. Any one of which would have been enough to be very embarrassing to any other administration. Where do we begin? It seems to be constantly attempting to re-wage wars of the past that he is clearly won. Whatever one thinks of Donald Trump, he is president and he will remain president, in theory at least for the next 3 years. He's beaten Hillary Clinton. No one's denying it. Move on. Yes, she's around the world giving a book tour at the moment, but that's fine. You know, she's a private citizen. This is the American dream. And, you know, she's out to make money and while the sun shines, effectively. The idea that he's now come forward and you played the clip at the top of the program, you know, suggesting that other American presidents have not bothered in their role as commander in chief to take the time to comfort the families of American fallen soldiers. When an American president statement which is demonstrably untrue time and time and time again, you've got to wonder what on earth is going on, quite frankly. He seems to be utterly unconcerned with the fact that he's saying things which are either outright lies or he doesn't know to be inaccurate. And that is the great debate here, is he lying or is he simply completely ignorant? And I don't know what the answer to that is, quite frankly. I don't think anybody has seen anything like this. And where it goes, you know, when you can lie so bold-facedly or be so ignorant on such an important and emotional issue, to turn around to say to a wife of a fallen soldier, apparently, he knew what he was signing up for, which is the story coming out of Washington overnight. I mean, it beggars belief, quite frankly, that anybody could be that callous, if indeed that was said.
Mary, I guess it's understandable that people look to the Democrats to see what the next 3 years and indeed that next sort of general election could look like. But here it's interesting, and James actually alluded to Hillary on her book tour, but she's had pronouncements and she's talked a little bit about Sanders, and she's talked about this idea apparently in London this week that, you know, all politicians want to be a movement or be part of a movement, and how that's maybe politically naive. Whilst simultaneously, Sanders himself has been trying to sort of galvanise exactly that, even though, you know, he was well beaten by Hillary before Hillary was well beaten by Trump. Are we learning anything about the future of the Democrats as Trump continues, however you would term his presidency?
Well, I suppose there's a really glib answer to that, which is not much. Mm-hmm. Because what has been striking is the extent to which Trump has been able to dominate the news, mm-hmm. not just by being sort of shocking and ignorant and saying all sorts of things that you don't expect a president to say, but because the Democrats have almost been missing in action. Mm-hmm. And you would have thought that after Hillary was defeated and after she basically not just ceded but left politics, you would imagine that the Democrats have really an open field to get their act together and to criticise and to do a decent job of opposition. So far, that hasn't happened. And almost you could say that the stronger opposition is coming from Senator McCain and a certain branch of the Republican Party in Congress. And the Democrats have actually been courted by Trump to a degree, so that they have been making, initially at least, until I think they discovered the small print, the Democrats were making common cause with Trump on the question of the Dreamers, the young non-American citizens who were brought by their parents to the US and don't have citizenship but have grown up there all these years. It is sort of amazing how badly the Democrats have been doing as an opposition, and they're losing time. You know, you're coming up, you're a year away from the midterms, you're 3 years away from a new presidential election, which always starts practically after the midterms. Where are they?
James, do you have an answer to that question?
Perfect. And I'll tell you what's actually interesting about this is that for the last 2 years, I was constantly getting asked questions about, well, why Hillary? Why should she get this? You know, there are other people who could run. Well, this proves a point. You know, the reason that Hillary Clinton got the nomination in part was the fact that there was a dearth of other candidates in the Democratic Party. Don't forget, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. It's amazing how he's constantly wheeled out by the American networks when they want someone to oppose Donald Trump. The fact that Nancy Pelosi and her team have got no one in the ranks to come through to challenge. And what I think is interesting is that the defeat that Hillary Clinton suffered last November was in many ways it ripped a bandage off a gaping wound that the Democratic Party have got, which is that as long as Barack Obama was president, it looked like the Democrats were doing fine. And you can make a valid argument, I think, that under Pelosi's leadership, they've done appallingly over the tenure of her time as leader of the party, effectively. They've lost the majority of the governorships across the country. They've lost the control of the House. They've lost control of the Senate. And what we're seeing now is the fact that, as Mary rightly points out, a far greater opposition to the Trump presidency is coming from a maverick Republican senator who has probably terminal brain cancer, and from Senator Collins, for example. And where does the future lie for the Democratic Party? Mm. The problem you've got is everybody's in their 70s. There's no young generation coming through.
But then what gives? I mean, this sounds like a recipe for a two-term Trump presidency.
Well, again, comes back to a point I raised in Hillary Rising, which is that you get a cycle of American presidential leadership for two terms to Democrats and two terms to Republican. Say what you will about Trump's surprise presidency, but on a secular basis, the Republicans were set to win last year and hold office theoretically for the next 8 years in office, be that with Trump or Vice President Pence.
Those are the insights of James Boyes. Mary Dzhevsky is still here with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up next on the programme, why the latest political satire from Armando Iannucci has received a cool reception in Russia.
For Monocle's retail-themed October issue, our editors turn their gaze to the plucky shopkeepers and business folk, looking beyond the dire headlines and still turning a profit by keeping our high streets lively. We meet the people behind a wise weekend market venture in Frome in the UK, the retailers rebuilding Italy's Porto Cervo and touting their wares in Taichung, not to mention a retail survey brimming with bright ideas in bricks and mortar. We also see how cities can kickstart their own revival, from Detroit to Yangon, peek into the studio of artist Gary Hume, and ogle the enviable new digs of an architecture practice who took over a dilapidated department store in South London, all before our selection of the 25 smartest sartorial finds from the world of fashion. All this and much more besides can be found in Monocle's October issue, which is out now and available from all good newsstands.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are James Boyes and Mary Dzhevsky. Veep and the Thick of It creator Armando Iannucci's latest satire, The Death of Stalin, looks at exactly that, depicting a comic reenactment of the last days of the Russian dictator. But not everybody in Russia, perhaps predictably, is seeing the funny side. Commentators in some Russian media have suggested the film is provocative and doesn't tell the country's story in a respectful manner, although it is a satire, not a documentary. Mary, Does satire get lost in translation, or was this the reaction that was almost certainly guaranteed from Moscow?
Well, I think there's two things to be said here. One of them is that Russians aren't averse to satire. They've had some very good satire shows on their own television. They had a version of the puppet show weekly. They've got some very good stand-up comedians who tour the country and whose shows are televised. It's not something that, as it were, they don't see or they don't have. But I think where you're dealing with something like The Death of Stalin, which is like a sort of set piece, a sort of cameo in Soviet and Russian history, and you have to look at it in their terms as something like, say, the death of Churchill or the death of the Queen Victoria. It's a part of history which they see as sort of surrounded with a sort of sacrosanct aura, which they're not ready yet to satirise. You can see their response to this. Not only is it's not something that was done by, as it were, their own satirists, but it's a Western satirist who's, as it were, invaded their national experience. It's, in a way, I would say the parallels are more like sort of the reception, the very mixed reception to, say, Life of Brian. In the Western world, which really had quite a divisive response when it first came out. So I think, it's not that Russians are immune to satire, it's that this is a particular sore point in a way.
James, there's something really interesting here. If you talk to many Russians, I suppose even anecdotally, there's still a certain, if not fondness, there's a sort of a wistful, a nostalgic element, Uncle Joe. And there was always this idea that despite the egregiousness, the excesses, the crimes perpetrated in his name, there's often this notion out in the country, at least, that, oh, well, if Uncle Joe knew about this, he'd do something about it. Is there actually quite a striking parallel with what we're seeing right now? I mean, Vladimir Putin out in the heartlands, he gets the same treatment. Oh, well, of course, if there is anything going wrong, Vladimir Putin doesn't know, and he has our best interest in heart. And there is this ongoing, it is a nostalgia almost, no?
Yeah, I'm loath to try to, much whatever I think of Vladimir Putin, comparing him with Stalin, I think might be a step too far.
Well, no, the more,
greatest
more, more
criminal
the public,
in 20th century
the
history.
The perspective but, the public but, has of their leader, though.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about ultimately here is the cult of personality. You know, and that links this story with what we were talking about with regard to China, for example, maybe even to a certain extent with regard to Donald Trump, the idea that, you know, the cult of personality can transcend reality, quite frankly. You know, it wasn't very long after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the dislocation of the Soviet Union that you saw people parading around Red Square carrying, you know, posters of Stalin. It's like, bring back the good old days, effectively, because, yes, there were purges, yes, there were gulags, but you know what? We could buy stuff in the shops, and the rising crime wasn't there. And you can look back on the good old days, as they were, with fond memories, as long as you weren't one of the people who were being sent off to Siberia and worse. With this story, I think it's easy to want to sort of take a sort of like a high-handed approach and say, well, you know, the Soviets have been a bit po-faced. But as Mary rightly points out, you know, the importance of Stalin to that country and his demise is something which I think is going to be problematic to be addressed from a Western point of view in the manner in which it's done. But again, let's flip this around. You know, we've got a president in the White House at the moment who is singularly unable to take criticism or any sort of ribbing, and routinely attacks Saturday Night Live, for example, for his being portrayed by Alec Baldwin, quite frankly, perhaps more accurately than he would have liked.
I think it's more accurately than reality.
Well, the suggestion is that there have been people who've left their post in the White House because of how they've been portrayed on Saturday Night Live. So the idea that satire can have a direct impact upon the direction of policy highs in the White House is something that's quite remarkable.
Maybe we'll return to that at another date. But before the end of the programme, I did want to talk briefly about juggling one's work-life balance. It can be tricky at the best of times, and that applies to politicians too. We've been talking about a few of them so far today. But Tory MP Douglas Ross is missing a vote in the Houses of Parliament today on universal credit. I mean, a compelling vote, surely that was to be, because he's going to be the assistant referee in Barcelona for a Champions League match. James Boyes, I don't know if you're a football fan, whether the allure of the new camp might extend to you, but is there a more fundamental question? How many jobs should a politician have? Surely the answer should only be one.
Completely agree. No doubt about it. If you were going to represent the people and you have a constituency, your first priority is to represent them. It becomes more and more difficult, of course, the more successful you are as a politician. You might get brought into form the government and then have ministerial responsibilities. But the idea that anybody in that capacity should have the temerity to turn around and say, I'm sorry, I can't vote for you, I'm going to be off refereeing a football match in Spain, is quite frankly ludicrous. And in many ways, no worse than editing the Evening Standard.
I don't know who you're talking about, James. Mary, on that point, not about the editorship of the Evening Standard, of course, Theresa May was very vocal in her defence, and she said, listen, you know, his constituents decisively elected him, they knew about his proclivities. I guess in this sense we should be grateful it's just refereeing. There are far darker secrets that some people have in their closet.
Well, I've got some sympathy with him actually going off to referee, because at least that is a completely different area of experience, which maybe sort of expresses somehow a sort of round character. But the idea that you have MPs who are moonlighting as chairman of boards, as non-executive directors, where there can be clear conflicts of interest between being an MP and doing that sort of job, where you've got people who are practicing lawyers, I think a few are practicing doctors, then I think you're not talking about conflict of interest, you're talking about time management, and you're talking about what is your priority. But I think at the same time that the British Parliament isn't alone in having become more and more professionalised in terms of politicians who've never done anything except politics in their lives. And so I think there is an argument for having more MPs who've got what you might call a hinterland of doing something else, which gives them a link to real life.
I wholeheartedly agree. So maybe just a yellow card to Mr. Ross for now. That brings us almost to the final whistle of this programme. Mary Dzieciolski and James Boyes are star strikers both. Thanks for being on Midori House. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Del Anna. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next, The Entrepreneurs, coming your way at 1900. And we'll have more on the daily at 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.